Chapter 8. Eat and Live. Like an unsliced belly, a fat silence lies over the lake. Dawn barely filters through autumn-yellowed reeds, but already the frogs are so loud that, at first, the people don't hear the horses. Instead, the ground under their feet tells them stamping hooves approach. The first thirst quench is the best killing time, and everyone knows it. Reaching the lake edge, the huge horses slow, ears forward, eyes scanning wide. They learn fast, and the people often change where and how they meet them. Today, crouching in brush, covered in scent-masking mud. Nervous snorts and horse scent heralds the herd's arrival. Flaring nostrils detect no danger. Muzzles lower, whiskers break the surface of the water. The horses' minds are cooled by the first flowing draft, throats relax. Then the reeds explode, noise, danger, screaming beasts and people, too many behind, forwards into the dragging water, spears gripped so hands ache, and the bite of the wood in the neck. A dark, stilled eye stares up from the lake, reflecting clouds and tree filigree above. Sluiced with blood, the floating bulk is too heavy to drag from the churned shallows where it fell and broke the spears. So they begin to unmake it there, in the lake. Swiftness is vital. High sun will be on them soon, pushing meat smell out into furred snouts twitching deeper in the woods. They heave the skin off, peeling the animal from the flesh. Hooves and tail are left on. The hide's first use will be to carry the meat away. The taking apart places are found and cut, releasing legs, then rump, head, neck, and lastly ribs. When every part is up on the clean sands, slicing and ripping begins in earnest. Watering mouths and lusting tongues are slaked by pink, warm marrow. There's too much to carry anyway. The flint's tearing slaughter song is joined by staccato rhythm as scraped clean bones hammer and resharpened tool edges. The horse unmakes itself. When fat heavy slabs, tacky with blood, are shouldered, the head, organs and tendons slung in the hide, the people begin walking. Warm sunlight breaks over the shore, shrinking the pooled shadows inside frantic hoofprints, illuminating puffs of wiry hair and blood-stained sand. Silence congeals around crushed reed stems floating in the lake. Settling into silty darkness below, snapped spears stab through time. Tonight, as 350,000 years ago, some bellies will feel deliciously full, while others ache in vain. Subsistence is survival, and it's always loomed large in Neanderthal research. But as any anthropologist and restaurant critic will tell you, food isn't simply nutrition. What and how we consume is woven into other fundamental aspects of life, from technology to culture. So, working out what was on the Neanderthal menu offers many avenues for exploring their lives. It's no surprise that a species living across such an enormous range of environments and climates ate many types of food. But our increasingly colourful picture of Neanderthal cuisine is also connected to more powerful investigative methods. Today, claims that Neanderthals couldn't eat X, therefore extinction, have been replaced by much more subtle comparisons between us and them. Even if food is more than fuel, biology still provides a baseline for thinking about diet. With more massive bodies and bones sculpted by intensive lifestyles, just how much energy did Neanderthals need? Moving heavily muscled and shorter legs is harder work, but so are unconscious essential functions like beating a bigger heart. And as brains are greedy organs, even slightly larger ones cost more calories. In total, we're talking a whopping 3,500 to 5,000 kilocalories every day. That's over twice today's typical adult guidelines, and even beyond what world-class athletes burn through. Yet, it multiplies at the extremes. Female Neanderthals grew bigger, heavier babies who needed more milk. Weanlings ate more food and needed carrying. That cost fell on parents and perhaps others. Living in tough and cold landscapes also pushes energy needs even further. Travelling through boreal forests filled with deep snow is especially draining. And some hunter-gatherers from these regions have been recorded eating gigantic amounts of game. Over 3 kilograms or 6.5 pounds per day, giving around 5,500 kilocalories. Since Neanderthals likely needed about 5 to 10% more energy on average, those from harsh environments and lacking highly insulating clothes must have needed up to 7,000 kilocalories per day. What does that look like? It's the calorie equivalent of a blowout Christmas Day binge. A fry-up at breakfast, roast dinner and champagne, cheese platter, plus leftovers and trifle for dinner. Each and every day. To feed a group of 10 Neanderthals for a week, you're looking at 300,000 kilocalories. Three reindeer every 7 days would hit that target, but it's almost 50% more than managed by typical wolf packs. And since human nutritional requirements aren't the same as wolves or hyenas, living largely on lean meat quickly leads to starvation. To get enough vital micronutrients, fats, vitamins, minerals, you need fat, brain, tongue, eyes, and marrow, implying double the number of animals. So while one massive rhino carcass gives 1 million kilocalories, it's not enough to stay healthy. Bony jigsaws. It's clear Neanderthals chowed down on an awful lot of food. But working out exactly what has been complicated. For a long time, researchers had nothing to go on except animal or faunal bones. But simply counting frequencies will be misleading. The trouble, once again, is taphonomy. Faunal remains can end up in archaeological layers via processes that have nothing to do with hominins. Random deaths, floods, or as carnivore prey. Early prehistorians didn't realise this, or overlooked it, and things only started to change in the second half of the 20th century, when claims Neanderthals were actually systematic scavengers emerged. This was connected to theories that true hunting only became common with later Homo sapiens, and predictably led to notions Neanderthals were too stupid to kill big beasts. Yet the meat thieves' idea was on shaky ground. Some hunter-gatherers do employ power scavenging, but exclusively surviving this way is extraordinarily hard, because carcasses with much remaining meat are a rare and massively in-demand resource. Hyenas are uber scavengers, typically arriving at a fresh carcass within just 30 minutes day or night, and can crack open all but the most resilient bones to suck them free of marrow. For anything beyond the meanest scraps, Neanderthals would have had to drive them off early and repeatedly. The final blow to ideas Neanderthals eked out an existence on grisly tatters came from the archaeology. During the late 1980s and 1990s, it increasingly became obvious that there was very little direct evidence of scavenging, versus an awful lot for hunting. Predator gnawing was almost always above cut marks, and this pattern of primary access to carcasses is there early. Despite wolves and saber-toothed cats lurking at Scherningen, they had to wait. It was carnivores squabbling over Neanderthals' refuse, not the other way round. Today's researchers examine every bone for telltale surface alterations. Cracks, abrasions, or stains reveal whether they lay on land surfaces or were quickly buried. While creatures also leave calling cards, tooth and beak marks, even acid erosion from stomach juices. It's often possible to identify the species responsible, whether hyena or hawk. Once naturally accumulated remains have been excluded, researchers then look for unmistakably hominin signatures. Burning, cut marks left by lithics, or distinctive battering and fractures of fresh bone. 19th century prehistorians' jaws would drop at the range of powerful lab kit now routinely used. High-powered optical microscopes pick out slice and chop marks, and electron beams trace the cross-sections of scratches at the nanoscale. Emerging biochemical techniques such as ZooMS can even identify the species of otherwise uncertain fragments. ZooMS, or zooarchaeology by mass spectrometry, is a rapid collagen identification technique that can determine the type of animal from even tiny, otherwise unclassifiable bone fragments. Individual bones are important, but it's assemblage-level damage frequencies that disprove scavenging. If fewer than 10% of faunal remains have carnivore gnawing, it's fairly safe to say most of the bones in a site came from Neanderthal food waste. Meticulous studies using such methods give us more detailed insights into their subsistence than ever before. Zooming into Fomane Cave, northwest Italy, we can see how this works. Known since the 1880s, its rich archaeology was only revealed in the 1960s when work on the adjacent single-track lane cut through sealing landslide deposits. The Fomane sediments are made up of numerous Neanderthal layers, including level A9, which formed over around 1,000 years between 47.5 and 45,000 years ago. It covers an area about the size of a school classroom, yet is just 15 to 20 centimetres, or 6 to 8 inches thick. As well as some 50 hearths and lithic scatters, A9 produced over 100,000 pieces of bone. Careful analysis unpicked their story, showing that just 0.1% of bones had damage from carnivores or rodents, while butchery rates were at least 15%. Of the 18 species, from cave lion to marmots, the most common were herbivores, and the bigger animals like red deer and bison had the most butchery damage. Confirming big game hunting is one thing, but much can be missed without systematic analysis of all bones and teeth. Just like the lithic manufacturing waste, many bone fragments were once routinely dumped during excavations, leading to inaccurate behavioural models linking tool types with particular ways of hunting. Recent re-excavation at Comgonal revealed that massive amounts of smaller animal remains had been thrown away during the work decades earlier by Bord, leading to misleading species and body part percentages. It also hammered a final nail in the coffin for the scavenging hypothesis, since the supposedly high proportion of teeth at Comgranal, taken as evidence that Neanderthals could only get heads rather than fleshy carcass parts, shrunk from 80% to just 2% of faunal remains. Uncritical use of data from most sites excavated some time ago must obviously today be regarded with caution. But as well as reanalysis, fresh discoveries over the past 3 decades have produced a transformation in our understanding. So, what did Neanderthal cuisine look like, and what does it imply about their wider behaviour? Hunting the truth. Let's get into the meat straight away. How exactly were Neanderthals killing all the beasts found in Fomane and hundreds of other sites. Spears are clearly one weapon, and in addition to those from Scherningen and Leringen, in 2018 the Eemian site of Neumark Nord II produced compelling evidence for their use. Among more than 100 massive fallow deer, mostly prime-aged stags, two largely complete skeletons aren't just smoking guns, but come with bullet holes, Neanderthal style. The hip bone of one and neck of the other bore deep, tapered punctures that can only have been caused by spears. Rather than being thrown, both wounds match experimental damage from being rammed in with a lunging action. On autumn days 120,000 years ago, Neanderthals at Neumark stalked their quarry through dense hornbeam forest to the lakeshore, where the canopy opened up to the sky and the deer had nowhere to run. The contrast with Scherningen, some 200,000 years older, is obvious. Those spears always seem to contradict claims that Neanderthals' shoulder joint anatomy prevented effective throwing. They seem too long for short stabbing spears or even dispatching lances, and moreover are weighted like javelins, which only makes sense if they were intended to be thrown. However, we need not think in binary terms, and it's quite possible such objects were dual-wield weapons. All spears found so far are wooden, but experiments show that slicing stone-tipped weapons have many advantages. The wounds they inflict bleed rapidly, sapping prey strength and reducing aggressive encounters. And there's evidence Neanderthals did use this kind of weapon. With probable impact damage on Levallois points from a number of sites, while at et al., Syria, the tip of a lithic point was found still embedded in a wild ass's backbone. However they were used in the past, spears neatly skewer scavenger theories. Furthermore, Neanderthals were quite comfortable taking on enormous beasts. The extinct horses at Scherningen weighed well over 500 kilograms, or 1,100 pounds, nearly twice the size of the species immortalised in Upper Paleolithic art. But what about the true giants, elephants and mammoths? Their sheer bulk and speed is incredible, but hunter-gatherers do successfully hunt elephants without guns. It's difficult to prove to a legal standard that Neanderthals also took down these behemoths, but circumstantial evidence is powerful. Carcass sites with butchery waste place them at the scene, and at Leringen, the weapon is even present. What is notable is that, aside from rare kill site skeletons, mammoth and elephant aren't usually dominant in Neanderthal sites. With creatures that huge, it seems that, rather than moving whole bodies or heavy limbs, Neanderthals were mostly transporting soft parts away from carcasses. And the amount of consumption overall could be an underestimate, since the thickness of elephant flesh can prevent cut marks showing up on bones. This might explain why no traces were found on at least 11 mammoths at Linford Quarry, Britain. A few parts from other species, horse, reindeer and rhinoceros, were butchered, but the presence of some 50 bifaces and thousands of pieces of napping debris points to more intensive activity, best explained by butchery and possibly hunting of the mammoths. Other sites are far less ambiguous. Some 100,000 years before the mammoths died and were butchered on the edge of the Channel Plain at Linford, Neanderthals were also living farther south on what's now the island of Jersey, within deep deposits of the ravine cave La Côte de Saint-Brélard on today's coast. Two mammoth-rich phases stand out. Unlike the densely fragmented faunal remains in other layers, these so-called bone heaps contain abundant mostly complete and blatantly butchered bones from at least 18 mammoths in total, together with some woolly rhinoceros. Interpreted for decades as a mass kill site, recent reinvestigations have questioned whether the cliff topography was suited to driving herds over. Instead, the bone heaps may in fact be taphonomic phenomena caused by unusual preservation. When Neanderthals abandoned the site at the onset of frigid phases in MIS6. Rather than being trampled into splinters, the butchered parts they left became buried in talcum-fine lerse, crushed rock dust blown from advancing glaciers hundreds of kilometres away. Submarine mapping in the past few years in front of La Côte has revealed a network of parallel gorges. So, instead of a jump site, Neanderthals may well have funneled animals up towards the ravine's cul-de-sac. Hips or shoulder blades aren't the richest body parts and are unlikely to have been dragged far. So kills must have either been very close by or actually inside the ravine. We're probably not looking at the slaughter of entire herds, but even a single cornered mammoth would be extremely dangerous and must have required teamwork to dispatch. La Côte has one more oddity. Some of the skulls were stacked against the stone walls, ribs placed vertically, and in one unique instance stabbed diagonally down through a skull. It's possible that Neanderthals were exploiting these animals' bodies not just for food, but as a means of structuring space. The best evidence for some element of specialised mammoth hunting comes from Spee in Belgium. A fair number of bones exist within the 19th century collections, but most unusually, three-quarters were youngsters, even very young calves. It's probably not down to other predators, as while hyenas sometimes target young elephants and were definitely using the cave, there's not much gnawing. Plus, neither hyenas nor other carnivores routinely transport massive bones like elephant skulls. The fact that young mammoth teeth were found at Spee strongly suggests that entire skulls had been present, making Neanderthal involvement more likely. However, like elephants, we can expect mammoth herds to have been very protective of their young. They're even tough for other predators to hunt, because they remain so close to the herd. The high frequency at Spee is therefore truly striking and implies targeted hunting by Neanderthals. The motivation for this probably lies in the fact that baby mammoths represent a rich resource. With about 1 kilogram or 2.2 pounds worth of concentrated fatty oil goodness in their brains. As well as being more nutritious, they may well have tasted better too. Spee may be unusual because of the age of the mammoths, but biochemical analysis on the Neanderthal remains there gives elemental proof for consumption that matches other sites. Carbon and nitrogen isotopes from hominin bones can give an idea of where they fitted into local ecosystem food chains. And on the whole, Neanderthals resemble carnivores like wolves or hyena with high nitrogen. Isotopes can also give an idea of predator diet niches, who was eating what. And remarkably, some Neanderthals, including those at Spee, appear to have been getting between 20 and 50% of their animal protein from mammoth. This supports the idea that the skeletal remains we find are only the tip of the tusk. Much of the time, Neanderthals were probably selecting only meat, fat and marrow to transport from kills. An interesting point to consider is that decades of mammoth myopia has somewhat sidelined the fact that Neanderthals certainly took on other colossal, dangerous beasts, including those massive horses, various rhinoceros species, aurochs, the fearsome ancestors of most cows, 1.8 metres or 6 feet or more at the shoulder, water buffalo, and giant camel. But, so far, there's no clear evidence for hunting hippopotamus, which, perhaps surprisingly, are even deadlier than elephants. Rather than focusing on big game, however, what defines Neanderthal hunters is their refinement of a way of life going back more than a million years. They went after almost all sizable prey in their local range, adapting to big species and medium-sized game. The diversity of habitats and behaviours represented by animals like ibex, gazelle, wild ass, boar, or chamois means Neanderthals must have mastered many specialised hunting strategies. But that doesn't mean they slaughtered indiscriminately. Just like furred predators, they flexibly shifted between being generalists versus targeting particular species, but almost always picking the meatiest or fattest animals. Canny use of landscape features combined with knowledge of animal behaviour must have underlain situations like the 50-odd horses at the Schoenigen lakeshore, which were killed in multiple phases over somewhere between several hundred years to just a few decades. Neanderthals returned again and again, probably because driving small herds into the water was a great way to slow down otherwise fast, dangerous prey. Elsewhere, hunters were homing in on opportunities offered by seasonal migrations or breeding herds. A particularly dramatic sight like this is Morhen, on the edge of the French Pyrenees, where there are probably remains from several thousand hunted bison. There are just a handful of bones from other species, but the bison are mostly females and younger calves, suggesting that Neanderthals could have been targeting them during summer, when they shifted from plains to uplands. Most interesting, although this context might have involved herd drives, the butchery itself at Morhen was definitely selective. At other places, solitary living species were also repeatedly targeted. Rhinoceros aren't sociable, and catching them needs careful stalking or ambushes at predictable locations. In interglacial forests, places with rock licks or even mineral salt-rich water would have been good bets. Judging by striking amounts of butchered rhino carcasses at Taubach, a late Eemian tufa site in Germany, Neanderthals do appear to have used some lakes and travertine sites in this way. This pattern of selectivity extends into how they used their prey. Body parts were understood and valued differently, and pop culture images of cavemen with giant roasting haunches are well off the mark. Instead of lean meat, the fattiest and most marrow-rich parts were prized to balance high protein intake and as a richer energy source. This means offal was certainly relished. Brains are around 60% fat, and grey matter is also full of particular lipids, long-chain polyunsaturated fatty acids, vital for health and fetal development. By reading the pattern of cut marks across the skeleton, we see time and again that brains as well as other juicy parts like eyeballs, tongues, and viscera were favoured by Neanderthals. Schoenigen shows how this worked. One horse contains far in excess of 200,000 kilocalories, but they're very lean. So Neanderthals skillfully skinned and took them apart, slicing off flesh from the meaty haunches and withers rather than taking them away. They paid more attention to getting marrow from the lower limbs as well as tongues and internal organs. But this practice was tailored by species. Smaller game saw more intensive carcass processing. It's echoed at many other sites, especially farther down the butchery chain from kill locales. At places like Fomane, where mostly marrow-rich joints from carcasses hunted elsewhere were brought back, almost every limb bone was methodically reduced to shattered shaft fragments. All the small things. Big beasts are certainly the cliché for Neanderthal meals, but smaller furred or feathered critters were eaten far more often than used to be imagined. For many decades, it was assumed Homo sapiens were more efficient, inventive hunters, and Neanderthals just weren't up to the task, since small game often need different strategies and gear, like traps or nets. This notion spun out into extinction theories, since if Neanderthals were stuck in a big game rut, they weren't therefore accessing the wider protein in a given landscape, and nor could they fall back on those species during big game shortages. But were they really killed by rabbits, or rather the lack of them, as some headlines claimed? Casting a more careful eye over the archaeology itself makes things look rather different. At around the same time that the Schöningen horses were dying, earlier Neanderthals were eating rabbits at Terra Amata, southern France. It's now just one of nearly 50 sites across Europe and Western Asia where exploitation of small game has been identified. Almost half involve rabbit or hare, despite them being supposedly hard to catch, and nearly the same number of sites include birds. Les Canalettes, a rock shelter high on the Causse du Larzac plateau, southeast France, is an interesting case. In layer 4, dating around 70 to 80,000 years ago, despite there being very few cut marks, researchers showed that nearly 70% of all identified bones were from butchered rabbit. This was thanks to distinctive breakage patterns. After a couple of incisions, Neanderthals could tug the skins off and, especially after cooking, simply pull the carcass apart. Incredibly rare, direct evidence comes from eastwards at the Abri du Maras rock shelter in the Ardèche Gorge. Natural mineral films covering lithics have, in some cases, preserved rabbit or hare fur strands alongside a few butchered bones. Rabbits elsewhere, and even the occasional marmot, were probably eaten like this too. But bigger rodents that take a bit more butchering were certainly also eaten. Beavers' fatty tails would have been succulent treats, and their architectural creations were part of Neanderthals' landscapes. At the northern French Eemian site of Oisier, as well as butchered beaver bones, the remains of a lodge were preserved. Multi-stranded analysis has increasingly boosted evidence for Neanderthal use of small game. At Peyre Rock Shelter, on the west bank of the Rhône River, they were butchering birds and fish from MIS6 onwards. Tiny feather fragments were on a tool used for butchering meat, while greasy polish from cutting up fish, residues of piscine mussels and even scales were found on other tools. Fragile fish bones are actually incredibly rare in archaeological sites, perhaps explaining their absence at Peyre, but freshwater fishing by Neanderthals wasn't an anomaly in that region. Fish scales have been identified on lithics at Abri du Maras, and, unlike Peyre, their significance is backed up by some 150 bones from sizeable perch and chub. In the absence of carnivore damage, Neanderthal fishers would seem to be responsible. Exceptional cases like that tip the balance in other sites with fish bones. Extremely fine sieving during excavation of Walou Cave in Belgium recovered over 300 freshwater fish bones and scales. None had predator damage, and what's more, they're most common in the richest archaeological layers. Right next to a river, Neanderthals here may well have been taking fish by their front door. But how? No certain hooks or harpoons are known. However, spearing or using stone traps in rivers are possible. Bears simply wait by a likely spot and smack the fish out, but subtler approaches work too. Fish tickling or guddling works well for shady bank-dwelling species. So much for terrestrial and watery realms. What about birds? There's now evidence for hominins eating birds more than a million years ago. And by the time of the Neanderthals, it's at so many sites that hunting must have been involved. At some places, it's not common, sometimes just single cases of butchered dove, swan, or duck bones. While back at Abri de Maras, there are a few feather fragments from birds of prey and probably duck under the mineral films. Elsewhere, Neanderthals were regularly eating birds over long periods of time. Three of the Gibraltar sites have a few butchered rock doves in various layers, while at Fermanagh Cave, black grouse, a classic game bird, was common. More surprising there are the large amounts of chough, a small cliff-dwelling member of the crow family. Chough, in fact, seems favoured by Neanderthals at many sites, including Cova Negra, Spain, where Neanderthals stayed for short periods during a cool phase before 120,000 years ago. Mostly hunting deer, wild goat and tar, a kind of mountain sheep, they also targeted a range of birds. Along with rabbit, butchered bones are found in five levels, but the richest is layer 3B, with over 100 bones from 12 species. Unlike Fermanagh, though, it's all medium or small birds. Partridge and rock dove, but also kestrel, owl, chough, jay, magpie, and the colourful roller bird. Despite being relatively scrawny, they were comprehensively sliced and nibbled. Oddly, for the crow family species, only the wings were present. Catching birds has long been believed an advanced hunting technique. So how did Neanderthals do it? Many species would have been living alongside them, soaring over cliffs above caves. But woodcock, jay, and roller at Cova Negra must have come from nearby woodlands. Special throwing sticks might work in wetland contexts. There are candidates at Schöningen. And though Neanderthals collected sinews and tendons and may have had plant-based cord, we have no evidence of nets. Similarly, nobody has ever found preserved darts or bows, but the small bone point from Salzgitter and the tiny Levallois points or even bladelets from a number of other locales must have been hafted and could have formed part of small projectiles. However, birds don't need to be caught on the wing. As with fish tickling, their natural instincts can be exploited. Some species will freeze on their nests, while today choughs in alpine ski resorts are remarkably interested in human detritus, providing ambush opportunities. All that sticky birch tar and bitumen could also have been used for perch traps. As well as meat, birds of course mean eggs, handy pre-packed protein, fat and vitamin-rich snacks. They're found at Schöningen and must have sometimes been greedily slurped down. We don't know if Neanderthals ate reptile eggs, but they certainly gorged on tortoises. Butchered remains are among the bones at Cova Negra, and also just 7 hours' walk away, though rather older, at 350 to 120,000 years ago, at Bollamore Cave, another site rich in small game. Rabbit and diverse kinds of birds, from swan to ptarmigan and members of the crow family, were eaten, plus at least 20 tortoises. The Bollamore Neanderthals even had a favourite preparation, roasted upside down to weaken the shell and soften the meat, then hammer open, tear off the limbs and slice out the innards. Tortoises, in fact, offer one of the best cases for a regional Neanderthal cuisine, as they were consumed at a number of sites across their native warm Mediterranean and Near Eastern regions. In some places, they're almost a staple, more than 5,700 remains representing at least 80 tortoises come from multiple levels at Oliveira Cave, Portugal, sometimes accounting for over half of identifiable bones. Intriguingly, wherever tortoises were eaten, they were often cooked inverted in the Bollamore fashion, though the shell hammering technique changed over time. And strikingly, there's no evidence for Neanderthals eating European pond turtle, even though they were found in northern Europe during the Eemian. Hunting small game, however, seems to have involved choice. Abric Romani is in a similarly rich landscape to Bolomor and Cova Negra, but none of the rabbits and birds from its long sequence show any trace of hominin involvement. And at relatively nearby to Shonaras Cave, Neanderthals were occasionally hunting rabbit, but not the birds. It's also noticeable that during cooler periods, unlike some Upper Paleolithic cultures, Neanderthals don't seem to have gone for Arctic hare. Perhaps big mammal herds provided more than enough food, and finding hares that live in the open wasn't worth the effort. Thinking about economics brings up another sort of subsistence that's relatively easy, yet until recently regarded as unlikely: seafood. Imagining Neanderthals sitting on a beach, slurping down mussels, is somehow even more incongruous than catching river fish. But beach combing, rock pooling, or even deep wading can all offer rich rewards for little energetic cost. Slow and laborious to collect, in nutritional terms, mollusks and other coastal foods are gold, bursting with vital long-chain omega-3 acids. Plenty of non-marine animals take advantage, from bears prying shells open with their claws to Asian macaques smashing shellfish or crabs. And recent findings prove that Neanderthals were also doing so, at least as early as our own species. As Chapter 5 discussed, most beaches where Neanderthal feet got sandy are currently underwater, following sea levels rising at the end of the last glacial period. Nonetheless, some sites on today's coast would have been close to interglacial shores and, depending on the submarine topography, within a few kilometres even when the ocean fell. Among them is Bajondio, a rock shelter in the southern Spanish city of Torremolinos. Here, in layers dating between 170 and 140,000 years ago, there's well over 1,000 broken up mollusk remains, almost all mussels. Direct heat forces these creatures to open their shells, and since many were charred only on the exterior, it seems Neanderthals knew this trick. Most interestingly, over several millennia, even as climate cooled, mussel eating continued. Shells only disappear when the coastline was around 8 kilometres or 5 miles away, implying that seafood continued to have importance even though other hunted game changed. In fact, the numbers of sites with some evidence of seafood eating is large, over 15 in Iberia and elsewhere around the Mediterranean. In the richest layer at El Cuco, close to the Atlantic coast in northern Spain, Neanderthals collected nearly 800 limpets plus the odd sea urchin, a delicacy in many coastal cultures today. And on the Portuguese Atlantic coast at Figueira Brava, there's striking diversity in marine creatures being eaten. The overall number of shellfish here are smaller, but this may be because they were being processed intensively. Within the sequence, distinct sub-layers of shells and fragments are visible, more abundant than the sediment. On top of that are the remains of well over 40 crabs and a variety of fish species that can be foraged from rock pools or in the shallows. There are no seafood sites known from along more northern Atlantic coasts. As sea levels fell, La Côte de Saint-Brélade in Jersey would have been reasonably close to the sea, but only for short periods. And Neanderthals seemed focused on big game. Meanwhile, at Le Rosel, a mid to late MIS5 dune site on the north French coast, wrasse, mussel, and thorny oyster are present, yet Neanderthals were apparently not eating them. Le Rosel does have rare walrus remains, a reminder of larger marine creatures Neanderthals could have sighted in the channel, though they lack butchery marks. Elsewhere, they did sometimes consume big beasts of the ocean. Dolphin, seal, and large fish bones with cut marks come from a few Iberian sites, which might represent washed-up carcasses or, perhaps, stranded individuals speared in the shallows. We can wonder what Neanderthals made of such creatures, with bodies both different and familiar to the terrestrial prey they knew intimately. Perhaps the most overlooked of animal groups that possibly contributed to Neanderthal diets are insects. Regarded as common sense nutritious fare outside Western cultures, they can be traditional bush tucker or urban street food. Eurasia doesn't have many massive fat grubs and larvae, but, like ours, Neanderthal summer days would have hummed with the background sound of bees. Hunter-gatherer groups, as well as chimpanzees, are well known to risk stings for the great calorific prize of honey. And if Neanderthals had the chance to try it, their ability to taste sweet things means they'd likely have enjoyed it. As we saw in the last chapter, hafting adhesive made from mixed beeswax and pine resin strongly suggests that at least Italian Neanderthals were well aware of other resources found in nests. In terms of actual insect crunching, however, we shouldn't rule out those closest to hand, parasites. Ticks and lice might be nibbled while grooming hair, and beyond Neanderthals' own bodies are passengers on their prey. Many of the large mammals hunted by Neanderthals would have had warblefly larvae under their pelts. These ravenous grubs, known as wolves, can be over 2 centimetres or 0.7 inches long, and after being laid as eggs in the host's legs, travel up through body muscles, reaching even the windpipe. All the tunnelling causes a noticeable jelly-like substance to form in the meat, and the warbles create lumps under the skin that leave holes. But on the upside, the hungry grubs are edible. A range of reindeer hunting indigenous North American cultures, including the Dogrib, Chipewyan, and Inuit, have regarded them as delicacies, comparable to berries. And since tiny Upper Paleolithic carvings of the warble bodies exist, they were definitely around in the Pleistocene. If Neanderthals were adaptable enough to gather things like limpets, there's no reason they wouldn't have gobbled up these choice snacks too. Fanged ones. Neanderthals ate all parts of creatures, great and small, and increasingly it's apparent that their Catholic tastes also extended to carnivores. While to some an unexpected choice, cuisine is a matter of perspective. Not so long ago, offal was everyday fare in most Western cultures, but today is largely demoted to unidentifiable stuffings or pet food. And the notion that carnivores are unpalatable isn't universal. Dogs and cats are eaten in some cultures, while in others, bears, technically omnivores but capable predators, are regarded as tasty. Many of the hundreds of indigenous societies of North America have traditionally eaten predators like cougar, wolf, and black, brown, and polar bears. They were sometimes fallback foods for hard times, but elsewhere normal parts of the diet. And depending on the season, for some cultures bears might be the main source of meat and fat. Plenty of Neanderthal sites exist with the odd cut-marked carnivore bone, such as wolf, fox, or dole, a now mostly Asiatic wild dog. Even butchery of bigger, more dangerous predators, like a lion at Grandolina between 350 and 250,000 years ago, hyena around 120,000 years ago at Montrevieso, or a leopard at Torrejones Cave after 100,000 years ago, all in Spain, probably represent chance encounters useful for food and furs. But with bears, it looks like something else was going on. Neanderthals hunted them more than any other predators, encountering 3 sorts: the familiar Eurasian brown bear and Deninger's bear, which after 130,000 years ago probably evolved into the cave bear. Even the brown bears tended to be bigger than those today, but cave bears were huge about 600 kilograms, or 1,320 pounds, and when standing would have towered over Neanderthals. They also, as implied by the name, preferred using subterranean dens rather than digging holes. Wherever bears slumbered, hibernation offered a relatively safe hunting opportunity, a fact known to lions and leopards, as their bones are sometimes found far underground alongside bear remains. But Neanderthals too were stealthy hunters in the dark. Among the more than 20 bear butchery sites in Europe are caves in the foothills of the Italian Alps, including Rio Secco, studied since 2002. Two layers there dating around 48 to 43,000 years ago reveal that Neanderthals slaughtered at least 30 winter-dreaming bears. As they processed entire carcasses, they focused especially on the fatty chest and limbs, as well as marrow and tongues. The bears' own ribs were used to resharpen the slicing tools and burning hints at cooking right there in the den. Other sites show that Neanderthals knew bears' habits well enough to track them even to high-altitude dens like Generosa Cave, also in the Alpine foothills. At around 1,500 metres or 5,000 feet, it probably required waiting until spring to ambush groggy and weak emerging bears. Spring den hunts may also be indicated by the presence of cubs, such as at Rio Secco. Fomane Cave, westwards along the Alps, shows us the consumers at the other end of bear hunts. The latest layers between 43.6 and 43.2 thousand years ago reveal Neanderthals bringing back choice cuts from bears hunted elsewhere. Some were burned, and tooth marks as well as marrow smashing even on toe bones shows the gusto with which they were consumed. Systematic hunting was also happening at Taubach, where Neanderthals not only ambushed rhino, but at least 50 bears, probably more. Carnivores and bears can be just as partial to mineral licks as herbivores. And so the Taubach carbonate-rich seeps and pools flowing down to the Ilm River were probably not only easily discoverable, thanks to networks of game trails, but also reliable locales for ambushing bear. They were certainly intensively butchered, even with defleshed paws and tongues removed, and once again burning may indicate that some of the bounty was cooked nearby. Whichever species, the lessons from Neanderthal carnivore and bear hunting are several. At least some of it, especially the bears, wasn't scavenging, but targeted, even specialised killing. This speaks to serious guts on the part of the hunters, plus collaboration and probably planning. Den hunting was clearly happening, but we should be open-minded about other options, like traps, whether deadfalls or pits. At first glance, that might seem rather complicated, but we've got abundant evidence Neanderthals worked on multi-stage projects involving wood, and, as we'll see in later chapters, they also created complex constructions. Shoots to roots. While Neanderthals' reputation as primarily big game fans is looking ropey, they're never going to be vegan mascots. Nonetheless, it's plants that underlie the most dramatic U-turn in our understanding of their diet. Preserved Pleistocene vegetation is extraordinarily rare, and this, together with visions of barren Arctic tundra, led to assumptions that plants weren't eaten, or in such tiny amounts that they are undetectable. Initially, stable isotope analysis appeared to back this up. The first Neanderthal analysed came from Les Pradelles, southwest France, and looked virtually indistinguishable from wolves or hyenas. As more samples accumulated, together with other evidence for active hunting, Neanderthals morphed from scavengers cringing around carcasses to macho killers, with little room for plants. Yet, even researchers knew this couldn't be true. Meat is an amazing protein hit, laced with fatty acids and easily absorbed micronutrients. But neither we nor the Neanderthals are capable of surviving long-term on 100% fleshy fare. Strict carnivory actually starves the body, terminating in protein poisoning. And for those pregnant or breastfeeding, likely the majority of Neanderthal women at any given time, it's lethal. Alongside meat and fat, Neanderthal survival depended on plants, and therefore the isotopic data wasn't telling the whole story. Sampling matters. There are fewer than 25 analysed individuals, and because of issues around preservation, they're younger than 100,000 years ago, and come from colder climates. Neanderthals who lived in warmer, plant-rich times and places are missing from the picture. Yet, even if we did have such samples, carbon and nitrogen stable isotopes only reflect protein, not carbs. Meat effectively swamps any plant protein in these methods, meaning that even if half of a Neanderthal's protein was vegetable in origin, isotopically they'd still look more like hyenas than horses. If Neanderthals nibbling roots and shoots feels unlikely, remember that other archaeological evidence points to their being herbaceous connoisseurs. If they were well aware of plants' material properties, whether for tools, hafting adhesive or other uses, why shouldn't this knowledge have also been nutritional? On top of that, the existence of digging sticks is strong supporting evidence. So, exactly what plants might they have chowed down on? The options were immense. Europe today has over 1,000 edible species, though they've mostly fallen off our cultural radar. In northern latitudes, there are slimmer pickings, yet indigenous tundra-living societies have long known at least 20 to 40 species that are good to eat, many of which would have grown farther south during colder climates. They include fireweed, or rosebay willow herb, sorrels and docks, berries, fungi, roots and tubers, seaweeds, and even some lichen. Even if only 1% of Neanderthals' diet during glacials was vegetable-based, over a year it adds up. Interglacial Neanderthals striding through lush forest, meadows or wetland had even more choice. For nearly 25 years, Near Eastern sites have pointed to this, most obviously thanks to water filtering of ashes from Kibara Cave, Israel. This recovered thousands of charred remains from nearly 50 plant species, a good number edible. Combined with other warmer sites like Amud and Gibraltar, the range of vegetable scraps in Neanderthals' hearths is impressive. Nuts, acorn, pistachio, walnut, hazel and pine. Fruits, palm, fig, date, wild olive and grape. Tubers, wild radish, bulbous barley and nutgrass. And seeds, grasses, peas and lentils. Even Eemian Northern Europe was full of options. At Neumark Nord and Rabutz in Germany, charred hazelnuts, acorns, lime tree seeds and stones from sloe and cornel berries indicate that these may have been eaten. The past three decades have seen the image of Neanderthals as the first Atkins diet devotees really unravel with direct proof of plant consumption coming from many parts of their own bodies, beginning when researchers peered more closely at their teeth. Eating produces wear patterns that can be linked to hardness of foods, and it's possible to distinguish between long-term abrasion versus microwear, a gauzy overlay of scratches and pits from the last few days or weeks. 3D scanning, modelling and statistical analyses compare the diversity and directionality of scratches and pits with experimental samples. And unlike isotopes, samples can include Neanderthals living in a mix of environments. And in general, as you might predict, individuals from colder and therefore less heavily vegetated contexts do show more meaty-looking wear. The Spee Neanderthals in Belgium even had wear similar to recent hunter-gatherers from Tierra del Fuego, who are known to have had a very meat-heavy diet. Yet, contrary to clichés of ice-bound lives, even cool-climate Neanderthals don't show wear patterns as extreme as recent Arctic peoples, including the Sadlermiut Inuit, many of whom ate dried and frozen meat and cracked bones open with their teeth. In contrast, teeth from Neanderthals, like the Tabunwan woman who lived in warmer and more lush landscapes, had wear from chewing tough, abrasive stuff, extremely likely to be plants. Crepina is especially interesting. It was probably occupied just before the intensive warming of the Eemian, meaning full forests hadn't yet developed. Yet, remarkably, the microwear from these Neanderthals most closely matches later prehistoric agricultural peoples, who ate a lot of fibrous plants. And a clear picture of individual variability exists. Woven through large-scale climate-connected patterns, Neanderthals from the same site and even the same layer aren't always identical, showing that not everyone was eating the same stuff. And you can zoom in further to other kinds of oral evidence, including the dental calculus many Neanderthals suffered from. A biofilm made up of mineralized spit, squished food detritus, and the remains of bacteria that feasted on it. Calculus is essentially a microscopic archaeological deposit of what was eaten. Stringent analysis protocols make it possible to rule out contamination, whether from ancient sediment or starches coming from researchers' sandwiches. Combined with residues on lithics, the new picture of Neanderthal meals is phenomenal. Out of some 40 sampled individuals so far, the prize winner for most diverse grot in their teeth is Shanidar 3, who we met earlier having been stabbed in the chest. Before this individual's death, date palms, plants from the pea, lentil and vetch family, and unidentified roots and tubers were all eaten. The latter also occur as residue samples on lithics from the same level, and artifacts from many other sites seem to roughly match the evidence from charred remains. They include seeds, nuts, leafy plants and fruit, pea family plants, unidentified roots and tubers, fungi and grasses. Grasses are especially intriguing because collecting and processing the seeds is very time-consuming. One or two cases might be dismissed as byproducts of collection for something like bedding, but more points to targeting for food. This is supported by the fact that seed starches from wild grass relatives of barley or wheat are also in some calculus samples, including Shanidar 3. Once again, diverse plant evidence in calculus isn't just from the Near East. All the way up in northwestern Europe, the climate at Spee around 100,000 years ago was definitely cooling. Yet both Neanderthal adults had traces of grasses and, startlingly, water lily root starches. These certainly imply that Neanderthals were actively foraging for plant foods and were quite comfortable wading about in water. A truly 21st century development in calculus analysis has been using DNA to try and identify foods, though as a technique, it's still teething. Among the scores of bacterial or viral matches, a few intriguing results came back. The individual from Spee with meaty-looking wear on her teeth had calculus DNA that matched rhino as well as wild sheep. Seeing as sheep aren't really represented in the faunal assemblage, could this be food eaten before arriving at Spee? Perhaps the biggest surprise was thrown up by El Citron. For the sample in question, dental wear pointed to a mixed diet, but the calculus had no large mammal DNA at all. Instead, matches for pine, mushroom, and moss appeared. This triggered vegetarian Neanderthals headlines. But the reality is complex. The mushroom species is widely consumed outside Europe and North America, but the pine is trickier. Some northern hunter-gatherer cultures do use inner pine bark as an early spring food, but the DNA-identified species is native to East Asia, which doesn't make sense for an Iberian Neanderthal. And the moss is tiny, has no food history anywhere, and is used in biotechnological applications, raising contamination as a possibility. On the other hand, it's recently been found to contain complex carbohydrates, so would have had some nutritional value. Perhaps this is a case where Neanderthals knew something we didn't. Certainly, someone at the El Salt rock shelter in Spain was eating plants, since hearth sediments have furnished us with the first Neanderthal feces samples. Aside from providing abundant comedy headlines, what the crap, poop scoop, etc., biochemical research showed that among mostly animal-based compounds, there was indisputable plant matter, probably from roots or tubers. Many of the new plant-detecting methods described here are still developing, and there's uncertainty in the details. But amid the harvest of data, one thing we can believe is that we're only seeing a fraction of the plants Neanderthals were really eating. That's especially true for cooked foods, which break down faster. And coming back full circle to the isotopes, boundaries are being pushed here too. The most recent studies homing in on amino acids still show animal proteins as dominant, but are now coming up with evidence of plants too. For the Spee Neanderthals, up to a fifth of protein was potentially coming from non-animal sources. Given that local environments at the time weren't that rich in vegetation, that implies some really focused foraging, and perhaps considerable processing by cooking. Homo gastronomus. So, meat and veg were, in some times and places, a fair description of what Neanderthals consumed. But how? Were there bubbling stews alongside fat-dripping roasts, or was their kitchen craft mostly raw? Certainly that's possible for some food, but cooking not only makes things edible, it also improves nutritional value and often aids digestion, whether meat or plant. While we'll explore debates over Neanderthal control of fire in the next chapter, there's good evidence for some level of meat cooking. Faunal remains that combine burning damage from different temperatures most likely indicate roasting on a fire, since bone would be burned more than areas covered by flesh. And some cooking would be largely invisible. For example, if Neanderthals were roasting fillets or organs, rather than meat still on the bone. Roasting megafauna is an old caveman cliche, but it's actually inefficient and fuel-hungry. Stews are better, cooking flesh while providing marrow-rich broths to sup. Then there's grease. Study after study show that Neanderthals were consistently organising hunting around marrow and fat. The animals targeted, the extent of butchery, and what was brought back. Moreover, the spongy, grease-rich ends of long bones are nearly always missing. Carnivores love these too, but in assemblages with no sign of their presence, we're looking instead at Neanderthals methodically processing them. This would be either boiling to render the grease or pulverising them into an oily bone paste. All this matches hunter-gatherer cuisines in cooler climates, which are often similarly focused on extracting juicy fats. What about plants? Grass seeds need soaking or charring and grinding, and though acorns are highly nutritious, they also require soaking to remove bitter tannins. Calculus studies back this up. Some, at El Cidrón, contained heat-cracked starches, and 40% of the starches from the Shanidar 3 individual appeared to have been boiled. In general, When the type of plant is identifiable, it's often those with hard seeds that benefit from cooking. Such complex practices put Neanderthals surprisingly close to the way hunter-gatherers prepared wild plant foods at the roots of modern agriculture. But how did a culture with no ceramic or metal containers do this? It's possible to boil liquid by putting red-hot cobbles into any vessel, but heat-cracked stones are very rare in Neanderthal sites. However, there's more than one way to stew a mammoth. You can simply hold the container over a fire as long as the liquid level remains high. It could be a large skull, a naturally hollow stone, or even a bark box. But one of the most obvious natural pots would be the stomach or skin of the animal you've just killed. Thinking about cooking raises the question of where the kitchen was. Some eating might have taken place immediately after the hunt, especially of less easily transported things like blood or organs. And burning at some big kill sites like Meuron might reflect meals during the time it took to butcher multiple bison. But as we'll explore in Chapter 10, there's abundant evidence that Neanderthals moved significant amounts of their prey elsewhere for further butchery and consumption. Even if we assume meat was shared with others waiting at places where game was transported, the hundreds or thousands of kilograms of flesh at places like Schöningen do seem rather too much to have used before spoiling. Given the risk and energy outlay from tackling big beasts and transporting the heavy joints, it would make sense if Neanderthals had some way to store or preserve their surplus. Doing so requires particular skills, knowledge, and advanced planning, whichever method was used, which is partly why it's been relatively little discussed. But there's also the lack of direct archaeological evidence. Unlike later prehistoric sites, we don't find any big pits, so Neanderthal preservation methods must have left little trace. Freezing is one possibility. Some Arctic cultures like the Inuit do this with fish, which can be eaten like ice lollies. During glacials, this may have happened by default and would actually have helped preserve vitamin C. Yet, much of the time, Neanderthals lived in less harsh conditions, so stored foods must have taken other forms. Another option is smoking. Calculus from two individuals at El Cidron contained chemical markers for wood smoke, showing that some Neanderthals were living alongside smouldering fires. But there may be other explanations. And preserving this way is perhaps more likely outside caves. Another way to view the burning at Meuron is as involved with conserving meat and marrow. But the simplest way to store meat, and the hardest to detect archaeologically, is by making jerky. It requires only drying, and can be either kept or further processed by mashing up with fat and marrow into something like pemmican. As Chapter 9 will show, at some exceptionally preserved sites, there are microscopic traces of pulverized bone fragments and cooked fats around hearths that might reflect this kind of processing. Storing plant-based foods would require quite similar processes to storing animal products. Autumn berries could complete pemmican-type recipes, while leaves, grains, or roots could be dried or ground. These would all have been more likely to happen at living places rather than while out and about gathering. A few sites do have enigmatic stone blocks with abraded surfaces, and at Lakina, some lithics have cracked grass starches that could relate to grinding or dry heating preparation. A whole other range of options exist with fermentation. By storing in low oxygen conditions, meat, fat, fish, or plants can all be allowed to go some way along the path to putrefaction, yet still be edible. In a way, this is like pre-digesting food, and it's especially useful for things such as brains, which are prone to going bad. Unlike cooking, this also preserves some key nutrients, especially vitamin C. A multitude of fermentation recipes exist today, some simple and others complicated. Game hanging represents the early stages, although sometimes mold can develop. Kiviak is more complex, a Greenlandic method where hundreds of little auks, tiny seabirds, are sewn inside a fat-smeared sealskin and stored for months until soft and green-tinged. Vegetable fermentation is also common, whether sauerkraut, kimchi, or fermented tofu. In many ethnographic accounts, fermented foods aren't emergency fallbacks or delicacies, but built into the normal diet. Can we believe that Neanderthals did this? The practice was already established 9,000 years ago among Scandinavian post-glacial hunter-fisher gatherers. And depending on the method, it's not cognitively very taxing. But getting fermentation wrong can be lethal. There are regular botulism deaths from eating badly kept seal or using the wrong birds for kiviak. Neanderthals already had multiple phased carcass processing systems, so adding another delayed stage might not have been hard. Keeping food underwater is one simple method, raising intriguing possibilities for places where we know animal carcasses were submerged. This includes horses at Schöningen or the mammoth at Linford. Whatever the method, fermentation takes so long that if Neanderthals used it, it may well have been something they left and only returned to after travelling elsewhere. Future teasing out of evidence for fermentation may come from isotopic studies, since such foods tend to become nitrogen enriched. There's another aspect to fermented foods, taste. Traditional fermented foods with strong flavours and scents, sometimes acknowledged in names like stinkfish, are nonetheless often anticipated with relish. Even without spending weeks ripening inside a marine mammal, seabirds are something of an acquired taste. But they're not far off conceptually from cheeses like Roquefort or Stilton, and apparently have a similar Moorish effect. Did Neanderthals salivate at the thought of marrow cheese as they crouched eyeing up bison herds, or smack their lips while guzzling lightly rotted reindeer? Living humans experience at least five tastes: sweet, sour, bitter, salty, savoury or umami, and potentially another that interestingly seems to detect calcium and fats. Taste, though, doesn't just signal what's good. Bitter sensations especially warn of danger, and genetics confirms that Neanderthals could detect one such compound. Known as PTC, it's found in some plants and is safe only when consumed in small amounts. Intriguingly, this Neanderthal mutation is different to that in many people today and was accompanied by another partially blocking PTC signals. This may mean Neanderthals had a higher tolerance for such flavours, and combined with genetic evidence for a wider range of bitter and sour taste perceptions, sampling unfamiliar plants or fermented meats might have been safer for them. The duo of taste and smell combine to produce what we experience as flavour. So it's even possible that Neanderthals lived in a richer culinary world than ours. Live to eat, eat to live. What and how we eat is deeply cultural. Even apes don't simply forage what's around, but follow what they grew up with. We use lithics to classify Neanderthal cultures, but food-based traditions were probably also part of their diversity. As hunters of massive prey, they certainly collaborated, but unlike wolves or hyenas, after killing together, they shared the spoils. Aside from mothers feeding offspring, chimpanzee hunters are far less altruistic, bartering scraps for social favour, including sex. That kind of reluctant cooperation isn't what Neanderthals did. they carried forward their collective action from kill through methodical butchery to moving the richest parts onwards, sometimes delaying feasting over three or more stages of processing. Salzgitter Lebenstedt shows this in practice. At least 44 and potentially twice that many reindeer were killed here in autumn, likely during different hunts as herds moved down from summer grazing in the Harz Mountains. Animals of all ages were skinned and filleted, but only the fattest, prime age males ready for breeding, were more intensively butchered. Neanderthals were after the richest parts of these chosen animals, going for marrow, fat, and organs, but less so lean meat. Such an obvious selective pattern couldn't emerge in a selfish free-for-all, but from groups with common purpose. The same thing is mirrored hundreds of times over in other Neanderthal sites. Zooming in on the butchery patterns themselves reveals a systematic approach far from a disorderly scrum. There were probably just a few, or even only one, skilled cutter per carcass, who knew where to slice so that joints would open, where to strike so that bones would shatter. Highly practiced Neanderthals, like modern butchers, leave more orderly, shallower, and fewer marks. So assessing number and placement may even highlight different levels of skill. It's interesting that there are much higher cut mark rates for reindeer limbs at the Pech de Lazé 4 rock shelter than the kill site of Jonzac. Since the sites are both keener technology and similar ages, this difference could be explained by the presence of seasoned hunters and perhaps other skilled adults at Jonzac. The messier pattern at Pech de Lazé 4 may well reflect the less refined slicing of others, including youngsters, learning the craft. Could Neanderthals have had specialised roles in subsistence? Sharing resources promotes the division of tasks, even if most individuals were multi-skilled. This may be visible in spatial patterns. For example, at Schöningen, marrow smashing was happening away from the butchered horse bodies. We'll explore task areas more in Chapter 10, but who actually hunted is another question. Women, on average, may have been more vulnerable during pregnancy and when caring for helpless infants. So, in evolutionary terms, risking rare offspring wouldn't be a great strategy. Certainly, in many hunter-gatherer societies, mostly male hunters deal with large game, sometimes living for days. But this isn't universal. Those societies with lioness-like women as the primary hunters are vanishingly rare. It's not unusual to see them join hunts, take part in kills, and dominate the primary butchery. And wherever they are, women and children frequently team up for local hunting of smaller game. Perhaps most surprising, in some hunter-gatherer cultures, tiny family groups, including women and babies, will head off seasonally into the land, supporting themselves for weeks at a time. Fundamentally, whatever kind of game was hunted or foods foraged, it happened within a social context. Neanderthals probably snacked together on what they found, children learning by observing what was portioned off to transport elsewhere. Tooth scratches show youngsters gradually making more grown-up gestures with eating tools, as little hands grew and managed better. In fact, children as foragers may have contributed a not insubstantial amount of food, and catching small creatures would have given them the opportunity to practice butchery. This may well explain why small critters like rabbit, which can be ripped apart, especially after cooking, still have cut marks. But most striking are the tiny birds at Cova Negra. Songbirds in themselves aren't necessarily odd fare, with many eaten as traditional foods or gastronomic delicacies today, with French ortolan among the most famous. In some hunter-gatherer cultures, songbirds are fallback foods, though in others they're regularly eaten. and it's often children doing the hunting. The species like swallow or blackbird being carefully carved, cooked and eaten at Cova Negra were butchered following the same methods as larger birds. Minuscule legs were sliced and the greasiest bones nibbled and pierced to suck out marrow. Rather than markers of starvation in an otherwise game-rich site, this would make more sense as a way for small fingers to learn how to cut meat, membranes and tendons. Perhaps within Neanderthal groups, there were other kinds of subsistence that followed particular social groupings. But what about hunting specialisation more generally? In places like Cova Negra, where the amount of bird butchery overall is very high and resembles specialised avian hunting in some later Homo sapiens sites, it's a possibility. Certainly, in other places like Chanzac or Moron, there is a dramatic focus on one species over very long time periods. But this is balanced by the impression that Neanderthals simply took the best of whatever local ecosystem they were in. Single species assemblages reflect sweet spots where combinations of climate, topography, and animal behaviour made catching them much more likely. Considering the centennial or even millennial scales involved, it's hard to know if there was a persistent tradition at work, but specific knowledge would have been maintained over at least several generations. Specialisation is one aspect of behaviour that, over time, has been used to characterise Neanderthals as less productive or capable in subsistence terms than early Homo sapiens. Yet this notion too has unravelled in the past two decades. For example, some early South African Homo sapiens populations gathered marine mollusks so intensively that millions built up in huge piles. And shrinking shell sizes over time implies longer occupations and over-exploitation. In contrast, Neanderthals generally seem to have browsed shellfish. Even places like Bajondio, El Cuco and Figueira Brava in Portugal, where seafood was important, were nodes within wider site networks across many environments. This generalist adaptation led to claims that Neanderthals were inefficient since they didn't fully extract available resources. But recent research shows in some cases that they did overexploit creatures just as easy to catch as mollusks. Over multiple layers at Oliveira Cave, tortoises became significantly smaller, likely reflecting overhunting, which may even have led to their Iberian extinction. In early Homo sapiens, this kind of intensive use would be taken as evidence of booming populations. So perhaps the same is true for Neanderthals at that time and place. More babies meant more mouths to feed. Better understanding of early Homo sapiens people has also shown how overarching theories about our success don't neatly stack up. Isotope analysis in 2019 showed that Neanderthals and early Upper Paleolithic communities from several sites in Belgium were virtually identical in their heavy reliance on meat, probably mammoth and reindeer. Even with technological differences, it doesn't look as if Neanderthal hunters here were less efficient. In the two decades since Schoening and Spears pierced through the heart of scavenging theories, how we think about Neanderthal hunting has been transformed. Even beyond such exquisite rarities, the literal weight of evidence, millions of animal bones from hundreds and hundreds of sites, amply demonstrates hunting prowess for even the most gigantic beasts. Smaller animals and even plants have become uncontroversial parts of millennia-old meals as researchers' analytical techniques have matured beyond imagination. All this has fed back into wider theories about Neanderthal bodies, cognition and social lives. Following from the micro to the macro scale, how tools scored through fur and flesh to the finesse of selecting the choicest parts to carry and eat, their self-confidence at the intersection between lithics and animal bodies is palpable. It's almost as if they could have done the job blindfolded. Nonetheless, Neanderthals' diet sometimes still ends up being framed unflatteringly in opposition to Homo sapiens. Niggling assumptions persist that they must have been doing something fundamentally wrong to explain why they disappeared, even though the archaeological reality leaves claims about our superiority somewhat hanging. Even if not at all sites or in such large degree, as a species they're far closer than used to be believed to the broad-spectrum diet that supposedly underlay early Homo sapiens' success. Instead of trying to pick holes in what Neanderthals ate, we could instead ask why early Homo sapiens became more specialised, despite it being riskier. Perhaps relying heavily on shellfish or small game might not have been a choice if they were outcompeted by Neanderthals for the best quality foods, large mammals. What Neanderthals didn't eat may also be manifesting other things. Plants or animals enjoyed by some hunter-gatherer societies can be ignored or even shunned by others. Just like smell, taste is part of the ancient core of hominin brains, woven deep into memories and identity. The scent of certain foods may well have evoked concepts of seasons or connections to particular places for Neanderthals. Perhaps those living in Wales would have been surprised, even turned their noses up, at what others of their own kind from Palestine consumed with relish. The biggest question is how it all ties together. In terms of their diet, Neanderthals weren't stuck in an evolutionary rut. Just like lithic technology, over time we see increasing proliferation and fragmentation. Their range of foods multiplied and animals' bodies were taken apart ever more carefully and thoroughly. The next two chapters explore how these patterns, from single hearths to entire landscapes, reveal them to be hominins who were moving things around at greater scales than ever before, and building new connections between themselves and the world.